Hi, I'm Linda from Little Farmhouse Flowers.
And I'm Emily from Bonchop Flowers.
And this is the Frost on Flowers podcast, where we dig into the hustle of cool climate cultivation.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hi there, it's Linda checking in as you get into this episode. We just wanted to pop in with a quick note. Emily was away on vacation when we were recording this, and she had a quirky internet connection, so our audio didn't quite sync up as we hoped, and there are some bits in here where we're talking over each other, and we apologize for that, but there's so much great content in here, and we wanted to get this episode out to you, all based around sustainability in our industry, and we hope you enjoy it.
Happy Earth Day, everyone. Emily and I are logging on today to talk about different topics related to sustainability in flower farming and floral design. And of course, this is a good opportunity to take a moment and pause and think about these things that really make a big difference in our industry. But it's also good to be thinking about these things all of the time and to build them into our practices and to always be working to be better. And I don't think either one of us would say that we're the most sustainable or that we do this the best way, but these are some things that we're thinking about and that we, you know, work toward. And I think that businesses that are trying to be more sustainable, they're always thinking about that. They're thinking about evolution and how they can be better and grow into healthier businesses. So without further ado, Emily's here with me today, and we're excited to tackle some really interesting things.
Hey, Linda.
Hi, happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day. I'm so excited to chat about today's episode and all the things we wanted to incorporate. So we want to start off with, you know, speaking kind of directly to other flower farmers and home gardeners about ways that they can be more sustainable as far as growing practices are involved.
Yeah, I think this is so interesting, fun, and we know that there are a lot of new growers out there, especially. Obviously, there's tons of good information out there. We've also heard in the past few weeks some not so great advice and information, and that's kind of, you know, made us take pause, and that's hard. And like I said, you know, we don't claim to have all the answers or to be the best at any of these things, but you know, if there are some things that we can help with, you know, we hope that these ideas will make a difference also.
Yeah, exactly. So I think one of the things, like in our own growing practices, I mean, we're trying to be mindful of what we're using as far as soils and amendments. I do a lot of building of compost and reusing soil here on the farm. I would say like 90% of my tulips and lily production are done through compost that we're building on the property. And part of the reason that we're doing that was we're trying to really cut back on peat-based products because they're, you know, something that we know is not really a viably renewable resource and something that we need to start being more mindful of, you know, as a farmer and a gardener, like, are we overusing resources and how is that going to impact the greater picture? And I know that's something you're mindful of too, Linda.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, especially right now, we're trying to work away from using peat and buying a lot of peat in. And, you know, financially this year, especially, those products have gone up substantially in price. So that's another, you know, just one more reason to not use them. And I think, you know, there are really wonderful aspects of the peat bogs that are good and healthy for our environment, you know, and in terms of controlling the release of greenhouse gases or serving as a nitrogen sink, you know, I'm not exactly sure, but there's a lot of good that they're doing, and we don't need to be taking away all those efforts, but by spending them on our own businesses and so forth. But you know, this has had me, and I know some of you have probably listened to our episode about compost, or you will be soon when that episode comes out. It's a really interesting conversation about in-vessel composting, and you know, all of this has us really talking about how we can do this better here at our farm, and we'd love to have one of these magical compost machines that we talk to the Culpeppers about, but until then, we're going to try to learn how to turn our pile better and make better use of it.
Yeah, it's a great way to incorporate good fertility into our soils too, like, you know, going to the compost model and moving away from purely buying in bags of mix and peat-based products. And I would encourage people to reach out to, you know, local composting companies and find out what their rates are. And, you know, I think there's also something to be gained from maybe collaborating with other farmers on building a larger compost pile, seeing what you can do to create your own in-house or collaborative composting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely a good idea. When you were talking about, you just mentioned lilies, you know, as part of your crate production there. Mm-hmm. Emily, one of the things that's been fun for us to learn and discover here, and I think you actually tipped us off to this, is the fact that we can grow lilies in the same soil medium that we were growing tulips in before. So, you know, for the last couple of years, we've been planting directly, and after we remove our tulip bulbs, we've been planting directly into the same soil medium that we were growing them in, because the lilies aren't affected by the fusarium, the other problems that we've had. So that's been a nice discovery, at least, you know, for some of this medium, if we are buying it in, there are ways that it can be reused also.
Exactly. It's like almost like companion planting season to season. Yep. But that's so wonderful, because you're like, you know, the soil's already in the crate. You're not having to dump it and turn it. It's just like you're saying, you're planting directly in. And there's a lot of other crops you can do that with also. I know there's some farmers who are, you know, pulling their tulip bulbs and then popping annuals into those crates too. So that's another way to make the most out of your square footage and your resources that you already have available, and not be buying in more product. So awesome.
Cool.
I think one of the other things we wanted to talk about was, you know, there's different alternatives to like seed starting and what you're using, as far as, are you going with like a plastic seed flat or a cell tray, or are you doing soil blocking? And, you know, the obvious choice that's more environmentally sound is to go with soil blocking, because it's eliminating the use of that plastic. And that's something that, you know, I'm not doing soil blocking right now, but it's definitely something that I want to move towards. One thing I don't do is I don't buy in any plastic. Just over the years, plugs that come into us from outside in, you know, 50 to 72 cell trays, we hold on to those, we wash them, and we reuse them. But there is definitely a really nice the concept of soil blocking is something that really appeals, because you're eliminating that component of waste. And I think if you're a farmer that's just starting out and you're trying to decide what you're going to go with as far as seed starting, I'd encourage you to look into the soil blocking methods instead of going out and buying more plastic. That's where I stand on that. I don't know what you're
yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And we have some of the tools for soil blocking here, and I've done it on and off in the past, and we're definitely going to be diving in more into it more here. You know, one of the interesting problems that you have as your farming business grows, if you have been doing the cell trays with plastic, you know, if at some point you run out of that stock, you have this option. Do you buy more of them? Like you're saying, you don't buy more. You have a nice collection there. But if you're a younger business and you're growing, you can actually reach a point where you're kind of held up by the cell trays that you have. And that's just not the case with soil blocking. So for example, we ran out of cell trays last week for 72 cells. And we are either, you know, going to wait until we can plant some things out and free up some of those cell trays, or do we just move ahead and jump into some soil blocking, and that way we don't ever have to, you know, slow down, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely opens up some options.
And it's very satisfying.
And then, you
stamping
know,
those soil block plugs are really fun to do.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing we really try to do on the farm is just be mindful of amendments and not over amending. I think this is something that you and I both get a lot, questions. I think people have this sense that, everything requires fertilizer, and what are you adding to your soil? And I think for me, starting off with a really healthy, rich compost, there's not a huge need for adding more amendments. But if I do need to be adding things, I'm making sure that I'm using, organic amendments always, and just being really mindful of, what am I using? Where is it coming from? Why am I using it? Is it absolutely necessary? We get the question a lot regarding tulips, like, well, what are you fertilizing your tulips with, and what do tulips want for fertilizer? And we both know that tulips come to us like completely 100% ready to go with all the energy they need in their bulbs. So it's actually not a positive to be dumping fertilizer or amendments into your tulips. You want to just let them be, and grow on in whatever your soil mix or compost is. But for me, using an organic, fertilizer, whether it's like for me, I'm using North Country Organics primarily is what I use, to add a little bit of nitrogen to the field. That's what I use. I know you use a couple other different things on
Yeah,
your farm
we
in
have some
the.
Nature's Intent organic granular fertilizer here. That's really easy to mix in with a soil mix if you're getting started, or to fertilize the beds in addition to compost that we might be adding. And then we also feed our crops periodically with a liquid fish emulsion, fish and seaweed emulsion that goes through a little pump right into our drip irrigation system. So that's super nice. We do that, for example, with the garden roses. After the first flush, then we fertilize every couple weeks between the flushes of roses. And I really love that. But it can go into everything.
And is that
No,
foliar?
it goes right through the drip tape. Drips,
Okay.
instead of just straight water, we hook up this little tank. They're really great. We should talk about them sometime, but so easy to use. I think some people get overwhelmed by that idea of fertigation and, overwhelmed by the thought of like trying to come up with the right ratio and proportions and mix everything together. But this little tank does everything for you. It's pretty awesome.
And now we're going to take a quick break for a message from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by our sister project or side hustle. Emily and I have been teaching students from across the country and around the world now how to force tulips and to schedule a program that will bring in significant income for their flower farming businesses during the off season. If you're interested, please visit www.bontrapflowers.shop and fill out our online inquiry form to learn about upcoming opportunities and our new filmed workshop, an online program that will be released in early 2022.
Something that's been kind of fun for us here at the farm this week is we have started working with a permaculture expert because we're designing kind of like you have. I really love the display garden that is over at your place, Emily, and we'd love to have a space at the front of our farm near the road that's also, is beautiful for people who are driving by and interesting, but also something for people to do when they come here to pick up their flowers. So we're taking what was just sometimes weedy, a very weedy area with perennials, and trying to like figure out how to make the space work, and we're going to turn it into something really beautiful. But our permaculture expert has been explaining how these really awesome mounded beds will be formed with lots of berry organic material buried inside of them. That's what kind of creates the height of the bed and create makes them more raised. But I'm so excited because he's teaching us how the beds are going to retain more water because of all of this organic content that's buried inside them, and how all of the, you know, organisms and fungi and everything are going to be all happy in there and cooking away. And I'm excited. I was asking them about the, what kind of, you know, irrigation would we need to add? He's like, I don't think you're going to need any at all. And I'm like, what? This is amazing.
That sounds awesome. I'm so excited for what that's going to bring to your farm. But I'm also thinking podcast episode.
Yes.
Culture specialist.
Definitely.
It sounds really,
so
really
cool.
Intriguing.
Yeah. I'm really excited. I think it's going to mean a lot of things. And it might mean that there are things we can grow here, you know, that we couldn't really do well before.
So I think the other thing that I know we've talked about this before, but I think if for new growers or even seasoned growers, I think one of the things that I really try to do is just be mindful of tips and suggestions from other sources that seem reputable or like they know what they're talking about. I think we all need to be mindful of doing our own research and, you know, digging in and diving in. If someone is telling you, oh, you really should use this amendment, I try not to take suggestions lightly. I guess what I want to do is learn more, and why is that person suggesting that? And is that really something that is going to be beneficial for what I'm doing? So I try not to take everything at, like, you know, face value. I try to dig a little deeper and do my own research so that I'm making sure that I'm making the right choices for, you know, my soil, my crops, my farm, and ultimately, you know, the greater ecosystem and environment that I have going on in my place. And I know you're really good about that too, Linda, about, you know, really doing your research and looking for more than one source. And I think that's important. I think it's so easy in this day and age of social media and Instagram and Facebook and podcasts to hear something that somebody says and take it hook, line, and sinker and think, oh yeah, that's a really good idea. I'm going to do that. I guess I would, you know, I want to encourage people to be a little cautious and do research.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, in particular, Emily and I can think of some recent instances when we've heard some people sharing information about, you know, basically trying to, like, sterilize soil in their gardens and get rid of this, that, and the other, you know, little, you know, fungi or disease or bacteria or whatever. But in doing so, you know, I think people forget there's lots of good stuff in the soil too. And, you know, you dump a whole bunch of junk on top of it in order to maybe prevent one possible disease in your crop, and you end up probably doing a lot more harm than good by getting rid of all that healthy stuff, right? Healthy bacteria and healthy molds and things that are really good for the soil.
That's a big one for us. Mm-hmm. Do your research, you know, figure things out before you just run and throw something on your crops or on your field.
I don't mean to skip ahead, but, you know, something else on our list is talking about pollinators. I know you brought this up in terms of including it in our episode, just thinking about, like, good things and not wanting to hurt the good things in our garden. Obviously there are some bad bugs too, but there are a lot of good bugs. And you had a really special tip for home gardeners and flower farmers about the pollinators, right, Emily?
Yeah, just that, you know, I think as gardeners and homeowners, you know, we get this, like, spring itch as soon as we get, like, you know, 60 degree, maybe we get like 2 or 3 days of 60 degrees in early April, and everybody's immediately like, oh, you know, get out the rakes and clean up the gardens. And ultimately, by jumping the gun, what you're doing is you're putting pollinators at risk. You know, butterflies, moths, bees are still hunkered down and being protected in that leaf litter and in all of the organic matter that's, you know, on the top of your gardens or on your lawn. And if you go in there too early, you're really compromising, you know, their livelihood. So we encourage gardeners and farmers and, you know, homeowners to please, you know, hold off until the temperatures are consistently 50 degrees and those pollinators have had a chance to emerge and go on to thrive in this next season. You know, there's such a threat to all of our pollinators, just given, you know, the change in environment and all of the nasty insecticides and pesticides that are being used and the impacts they're having on them. So, you know, that's one small thing that we can all do to really try to help support them, which is so important for our flowers, for our food. Being mindful and careful is really important. So I think that was definitely something I put out on my Instagram, which I got by way of another gardener who's I really respect. And so be careful and mindful of those pollinators. You know, just take a breath, go for a walk or a bike ride, or, you know, go do something else and just let your gardens be for a minute. You know, you'll get to it eventually, and you'll be happy you waited, because then you'll have all those happy pollinators there taking care of pollinating your, you know, crab apples and your apples and your flowers and all those things.
I guess that has me thinking also about, you know, when maybe later on in the season, folks start to have some undesirable bugs or undesirable insects in their gardens. And obviously there are a lot of different ways to handle that situation, but, you know, we're both dedicated to trying to be as responsible as possible. And for us here, sometimes that means integrated pest management. Sometimes it means, you know, hand picking or hand squishing the bad guys and looking for them every morning. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of those red lily beetles.
They're the worst.
We also, you know, buy in beneficial insects. A lot of flower farmers are doing that, which is pretty awesome. And, you know, we can talk with our integrated pest management specialists and specifically get beneficial insects that will go after the problem pests.
For sure. We do that here also. And like you're saying with the lily leaf beetle, I think one of the most frequent questions I get when I post about lilies is like, what do you spray them with? And I always kind of cringe inside. I'm like, why do I always have to be spraying something? You know, the reality is I don't spray them. And like you're saying, I do a early morning walkthrough every morning. I look for them when they're moving slow in the morning and I hand pick. And I do the same thing midday and I do the same thing in the evening. And, you know, it's pretty mindful. It's meditative. It's keeping me really keyed into what's happening with the crop and aware of, you know, are things getting enough water? And, you know, what is the environment like in the house where they're growing? Is it too hot midday when I'm doing my walk? Do I need to be adding more ventilation? And that is the only way that I'm able to keep them under control, is just by like doing those walks and doing that picking. And I know a number of people who talk about spraying the lily leaf beetle specifically, and how it's not successful for them. So I would just encourage people to, you know, don't go right to that, like, let's spray to get rid of something. You know, you want to find balance. And like Linda's saying, if you can bring in, you know, beneficial, say, ladybugs to eat up the aphids that are going after your crop, you know, you're letting nature do what it's meant to do. You know, you're giving an assist by bringing in those beneficials, but that is just so much more of a healthier dynamic than bringing in some kind of a spray.
Totally.
I think the other thing we wanted to talk about in growing is thinking about growing crops that work with your growing zone and your climate, and being responsible in that way. You know, Linda and I, we live in zone 4. Are you something?
Yeah, I think like 3B, 4A, although everything seems warmer the past few years. Really seems to be changing, but yeah, totally.
Yeah, so I think thinking about, you know, what crops you're growing. You know, we both focus primarily on cool crops because we're in a cool area. And, you know, neither one of us are trying to grow, you know, major tropicals in winter or crops that just don't make sense. You know, we're really trying to focus on the crops that can handle our climate and thrive here. And we'd encourage other people to really be mindful of that and think in that same way, so that you're not putting tons of energy into, you know, having to overheat or expend resources unnecessarily And ultimately, the crops that are going to do better for you are the crops that are more suited for your environment. So, you know, we encourage you to focus your energy
definitely
there.
I think one of the most important things or revelations that we've had since we moved here to this area has been just really observing and taking in all of the different species that are surviving and thriving around here naturally, especially because of the harsh climate. Also, you know, love, you know, kind of taking note of what people are growing in their home gardens who have, you know, more established plants that have been here for years and years and years, and trying to choose varieties here that, you know, are maybe close relatives of the native species that are kind of maybe more seen as weeds or more weedy. But, you know, if there's a, for example, we have a lot of dogwood and different kinds of viburnum growing all around the edges of the meadow, kind of naturally. And, you know, that's a nice tip to us that, you know, maybe we can grow some, you know, of the more kind of fancy or floral industry, you know, desirable types of flowers and plants and woody perennials that are related to those. So that's been fun. We have kind of this whole area in the garden that's really swampy that we didn't really know what to do with, but we took cues from nature, from the area, you know, right outside of our line in terms of what we should plant there. And it's going really well. So
I think the other thing is like you're saying, like, think about your natives. Like, if you're going to add perennials, like, go to your local garden center and ask them, like, you know, which are your native perennials, and look into that and see if they do well as cuts, if you're looking for them for cutting stock, or if you're just looking for stuff to add to your garden. I can say at the greenhouse, that's something that my parents take really seriously, is making sure we're offering local native species. So I'd encourage people to definitely do that.
Awesome. Should we move on to some post-harvest ideas, some packaging ideas and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the huge one for me, and this is something that I think applies to other growers and farmers, but I also really want our customers and consumers who are buying flowers to think about this and kind of put it on their radar, this idea of, you know, single-use plastic, which in Vermont, the legislation has passed, and we're now single-use plastic is prohibited. So when you go in the grocery store, that those aren't options, you know, plastic bags, same thing with, there's a straw law, and we're really trying to cut down on single use. And, you know, we both are using craft paper sleeves, which are recyclable, versus plastic. And I would encourage other farmers to look into using paper versus plastic. I know for myself, a few years back when I made the change, I can remember like bunching a ton of bouquets for Valentine's Day and just like looking at the number of plastic sleeves that were going out. And I think I just watched a documentary and had seen, like, you know, the mass of plastic floating in the Pacific. And I was just thinking to myself, like, oh my God, am I truly sending this beauty out the door with all this plastic around it? And is that ending up in our oceans? And if that's the case, like, ugh, like, that is the worst feeling. Like, I can't live with myself if that's the case. And I immediately after that was like, all right, I got to find the alternative. And I did find the alternative, which is the paper. And obviously there's like, here's the thing, there's like no perfect solution, right? You know, creating a paper sleeve, there's environmental impacts to that too. But you know, it's the lesser of the two evils, and that it can be recycled, and you know, it's not going to be leaching plastic for, you know, centuries into our environment. But moving to paper has been good for me in more ways than one. You know, immediately after I made the switch, I actually had a couple customers say to me via email, you know, thank you so much for switching to paper. I actually never bought your flowers because they were in plastic, and it was so, you know, disturbing to me that these beautiful, you know, gifts of nature are being packaged in that way. And I just thought, well, that's really interesting. No one had ever told me. And if I had known, I would have you know, that might have sparked me to switch to paper sooner. So I think, you know, if you are a farmer and you're still using plastic, we would really encourage you to think about making the shift. I will say, as far as cost is involved, I haven't found it to be any more expensive than plastic. I like the look better than plastic. And, you know, more than that, it's just, it's the more responsible and sustainable thing to do.
Yeah, 100% agree.
And it's not just like us as farmers bringing our flowers to market. I mean, I think, you know, I'd also encourage people in floral design. You know, if you're a florist shop and you're making your bouquets and you're sending everything out in plastic, like, there is an alternative for you. And I would encourage you to consider that. You know, like, I think deeply about the fact that, you know, as farmers or growers or people who are, we have the privilege of working with these gifts that are growing from the earth. You know, like, I see us as stewards, you know, of the land. You know, we're harvesting this beauty and then we're like wrapping it in basically something that's trash. You know, that is like just, you know, such a conflict of interest, kind of, you know, just visually thinking about it and breaking it all down. You know, this beautiful, beautiful thing, these flowers that, you know, are growing for us are then being wrapped in a way that is, you know, then kind of like, I don't know how to say it without saying it like this, but like basically just dropping, you know, refuse or garbage. You know, it's leaving behind, beauty is then leaving behind this trail. And it's not because of the beauty, it's because of us and the choices that we're making. And, you know, like, come on, we can be better. So as stewards of land and beauty, make those choices that are going to have the less impact.
I love it.
That's my soapbox.
And in that vein, Emily and I have both transitioned our businesses to marking our craft paper sleeves with a rubber stamp rather than, you know, a plastic coated sticker. That's another really easy way to be more sustainable in your packaging. And it's a lot cheaper too. It's so much cheaper. And you don't have to reorder stickers all the time.
So much
and,
cheaper.
You know, I do on some of the Facebook flower farming feeds once in a while see a post of someone looking for information. You know, where do you get your stickers? And there are obviously there are companies out there that make these stickers that are designed to hold up against moisture, you know, and different temperatures and all of that. It's because there's some kind of, you know, additive to the sticker or they're plastic coated or something that allows them to hold up in that way. But a rubber stamp works amazingly well, super fast, faster than peeling stickers, I think. And you know, it's just so simple. So you can order a rubber stamp with your logo on it online and get right, move right ahead. And I think a lot of people are moving in that direction, but we still see the stickers sometimes. So
yeah. And with a sticker, it's like the garbage of the sticker going on the sleeve. But the other thing before I move to a stamp is just the number of like peel away, you know, the backing on the sticker, all of that garbage, which is not recyclable. It's, you know, it is, you know, something that has to go in the trash. So, you know, eliminating that waste by going to a stamp is huge. One of the tips that we've come up with at our farm, because sometimes we found that, you know, I'll mention in just a minute the stamp companies we use, but we found that the stamp wasn't always printing perfectly on the sleeve. So we were like maybe missing little bits of our image. My friend who works with me, Emily Church, we were trying to figure it out. We were like, do we need a harder surface? And then ultimately we were like, no, it's not that we need a harder surface. It's that we need a softer surface so that you can make sure you're making enough contact with the entire stamp. And so she brought in, you know, an old style mouse pad and, you know, for a computer mouse. And we put that underneath our sleeves when we're stamping and we get like the perfect stamp every time because of it, because it's giving just that little bit of cushion and give so that your all your surfaces are connecting perfectly on your sleeve. So that's one of our little tricks that we do.
Such a good tip. And most people don't need to use mouse pads anymore. We all have, you know, built in. So there you go. New use for your,
all right, yeah, your mouse so pad. Repurpose your mouse pads. And so the places where I have gotten my stamps in the past are either rubberstamps.com and then also Rubber Stamp Champ. And those were both places that I ordered online through both those companies, and their turnaround was pretty fast. I think both of them gave the option of uploading a logo, or gave you the option of like creating something within a template that they had online. So it was really simple and easy.
We used rubberstamps.net, not .com. So obviously there are some competing businesses out there, but they worked great for us. And all different kinds of, you know, sizes are available. And I think ours is a 3-inch by 3-inch round shaped stamp. So that's what works for us.
Yeah, same. I've got some, I think I do 2-inch on my smaller sleeves for like my Narcissus and our Anemone. And then we use the 3x3 for the bigger sleeves. And then I also have even a 4x4 for the really big lily sleeves. So we've got options. But yeah, I wish I had made the switch to paper sleeves and a rubber stamp a long, long time ago. And if I was starting out, that's what I would do.
Awesome.
So a couple tips.
Cool. All right. Well, we have some ideas to share with people who maybe aren't growers, who are designing with flowers, or who are, you know, just enjoying flowers in their own homes. And these are things that are important, I think, to us and to the sustainable, you know, flower industry on the whole. And one of the very first things is to look local first, look for local flowers. You know, we've all heard stories, or many of us have heard stories, about how the flower industry in the US used to be quite big. And that, you know, since the 70s and 80s, it's been really shrinking and shrinking in size. And maybe there's a rebirth going on now. We kind of see some of that, but we have, you know, plenty of land, plenty of willing people to grow flowers here. And we sure hope, you know, that people will start to consider local flowers instead of things that are being shipped in from far away with huge carbon footprints and pesticides and all kinds of undesirable characteristics.
Yeah, for sure. And just the fact that the stuff that's being grown local, like you're saying, it's a low carbon footprint, but you're also going to end up with fresher, healthier flowers on your table. And I think it's good to know your farmer, know where your stuff is coming from. Because that's going into your home, it's bringing beauty to your home, it's going on your table near your children and your pets. And like Linda's saying, the stuff that's flown in can be covered in a whole number of really kind of gross, toxic things. So, you know, support your local growers, seek them out. And I think even further than that, if you're a consumer or customer, you know, encourage your local floral designer to be buying from local flower farmers and ask them questions. I think we need to really hold each other accountable. You know, where are these flowers coming from? What do you know about them? How are they treated when they've come in to the States? What is your commitment to trying to have clean flowers in your shop? And until we, as like, you know, a whole community of flower lovers and consumers, all kind of get on the train, to, you know, try to affect change and expect, you know, cleaner flowers and more of designers and growers, it's not going to happen. So I think, you know, ask questions and ask. Definitely. And seek out local.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, you know, obviously a lot of change that can come within industries from the growers, from the people who are selling flowers, but a lot of that change is also driven by consumer demand. So when people start, you know, if they're buying flowers, asking where things are from, asking why they are presented in plastic instead of in paper, or could they be in paper next time? Or, you know, I'd rather buy flowers from you if they were, you know, packaged more sustainably. Those are, you know, the types of questions and requests that really can change the industry. So hopefully some of this consumer education will play a role in making changes too.
I think the other thing I want to just mention in thinking about that, and thinking about flowers that are coming in from elsewhere and maybe not being grown in the most eco-conscious way by a local flower farmer. I had a conversation once with a couple different, I've had the conversation more than once now at this point, with a couple different produce buyers just about the fact that, you know, flowers that are coming in from outside of this country were, you know, we know they're being treated with things that, you know, would not fly on our farms. You know, it's pesticides. There's all sorts of things going on flowers. So when you're bringing those home and you have them in your home and then the flowers, you know, finish and you're getting ready to get rid of them, I know a number of people who let me know that they'd be putting those flowers into their compost, and then their compost, you know, as it's breaking down, they're adding it to their garden where they're, like, you know, growing small veg gardens in their backyard for their own, you know, food for their table. You know, I would really encourage you to be mindful of not putting flowers that you don't know where they're coming from or what could be on them in your compost, because you could be adding all sorts of nastiness to your compost that's coming in on those flowers. So another reason to seek out local eco-grown blooms is so that you know, what their growing practices are, and ask. If you're not sure, if that's not very clearly apparent from your local flower farmer, ask them what their practices are. It's another way to hold everybody accountable. If we keep asking questions and asking for transparency, that's going to really help. But I would just also encourage you to be careful about what you're putting in your compost.
Yeah, definitely. That you may and be having on especially, your table. You know, now we're seeing that's been very trendy for people to be buying all these flowers that have been treated in different ways. They've been painted or bleached or dyed with, you know, goodness knows what, but those kinds of, so gross, those kinds of treatments, you know, we're talking so about gross. Like spray painting flowers with acrylic paints. Like, obviously you put plastic coating on a flower, it's not a compostable product anymore. Or, you know, if you try, when it goes back into the land, all those little bits of plastic are shed off as the plant material eventually, you know, dies back or decomposes itself. And all those little tiny bits of plastic, where do they go? And they go into your water or into, you know, your plants or the animals. And yeah, so troubling. So yeah, be mindful of all that stuff and don't buy it. Don't buy the dyed and painted and bleached crap. It's such junk.
It's so toxic. And again, it's like, I look at it through this lens, like, nature is giving us such incredible beauty. Why are we crapping on it? Why are we painting it? Why are we bleaching it? Why are we creating more and more toxic garbage, like the, you know, the remnants of the bleaching process or of the dyeing process, and then the flowers themselves after they've gone through those processes? And why are we exposing, you know, people in our environment to that? Like, I can't even wrap my mind around it. It's like the worst level of consumerism to me, that people are, like, you know, because the reason it's happening is because people are driving that, you know, people are wanting it. I see so many posts come up on Instagram where, you know, it's dyed carnations or dyed tulips, and everybody's like, ooh, ah, it's so amazing. And I just want to be like, stop, stop for one moment. Like, go dig beyond what you're seeing visually. Like think about what that is and how that's created and what is the impact. I think we're so used to that, like, you know, immediate gratification that it, like, almost stunts us. Like, you know, oh, it's beautiful, it's dyed, yay. No, just stop for 1 second and, like, take a moment and think about what that is and what that's creating. And stop liking it and stop buying it, because that's contributing to, you know, just the ugly side of the floral industry that is just really not necessary.
Yeah,
it's bothersome to me. I'm sure it's apparent how I'm talking about it, but it makes me crazy. There's so much natural beauty that we could be appreciating instead of trying to change it and tweak it and make it garish.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think one of the arguments that I hear, you know, for those types of products is that, you know, this is an art form, that the florist is an artist creating something sculptural, and as an artist myself and a former art teacher, I think that's really important that florists recognize that their work is impermanent. You know, even these dyed and dried and things, whatever designs made with them are going to get dusty and eventually be, you know, cast away, if not, you know, sooner than something that's fresh. But anyhow, what I'm getting at is that, you know, for me, it's different painting a canvas with some acrylic paint, you know, this plastic base that's intended to be, you know, last for generations and very long term. That's in a different kind of intended use. You know, when we do that to, when we paint natural products or bleach or chemically treat, you know, whatever we're doing, we're essentially, you know, yeah, we're creating garbage. And I know I've had some interesting conversations in past, you know, podcast episodes with the folks over on the Sustainable Flowers podcast. And those have been really interesting. But, you know, I'm thinking, you know, Becky Feasby refers to that as making garbage. You take something natural and you made garbage, because now it can't be returned to earth as it should be.
Please don't encourage or endorse making more garbage. Sure. That's a big thing. And I think along that vein, like we've talked a little bit, I don't know that we've brought this on the podcast, but, you know, floral foam is something that we both definitely don't use in our practice, and for so many good reasons. And I know you've, as part of the Sustainable Floristry Network, have talked about that a little bit. But do you want to maybe just...
Yeah, sure. So I think, you know, first of all, that it's important to keep talking about floral foam, because I know it probably sounds repetitive, and, you know, there are many people who have moved away from it now, but there's still tons of people who are using that trash, and it's still being produced. But basically, you know, this Oasis foam product, whether or not it's labeled biodegradable, both versions, break down into microplastics that have been found through, you know, scientific research to be consumed by our, you know, aquatic microorganisms. And that's how they are entering our food system or working their way up through different kinds of animal life. So disturbing. So, you know, Emily and I and many other farmers, and I think that's a huge growing contingency of both farmer florists and florists who are no longer using that and who are trying to reclaim whatever sort of design mechanics they're using, be it chicken wire or water tubes. You know, they're using things that are reusable and reclaimable, and they're basically going back to different forms of floral construction that were, you know, popular before the invention of foam. The foam's a relatively new invention, and beautiful arrangements and displays and floats and, you know, you name it, all of that was being made before the invention of foam. So it's been really interesting to see people actually go back and into history and see, you know, what were people doing before? We don't need to use this stuff. There were other ways. There are other ways. And, you know, I love following different florists, you know, Sue McCleary, Passion Flower Sue. It's so interesting to see all the different things that she comes up with. She's been using something called snow fungus lately. That's so cool. natural plant material, so that can, you know, fungus that can anchor your stems and hold them upright. That's pretty amazing. I love that.
And for you, you know, in your mechanics, what would you say you use?
Yeah,
the most
I'd say chicken wire. And we're using almost solely vessels from our rental collection. So I'm reclaiming after the event, or after the customers are done enjoying the flowers, I'm reclaiming the vessels, putting the whatever plant material has been left for us, you know, into compost. And then those chicken wire, you know, small balls of chicken wire, those get reused too. So that's really great. And I've seen all kinds of really interesting ways that folks mm-hmm. are anchoring their chicken wire into their vessels. Some people are just using, you know, some twine to kind of tie it to the rim of their bowl or their vase, something like that, you know, instead of even using tape. So really getting away from all of the, any kind of, you know, trash that mm-hmm. could be created through the event work. That's pretty awesome.
And I love the idea of reusing your vessels. I mean, I think about the number of weddings where, you know, 25 table arrangements go out, and those, you know, what happens to those vessels? Like, where do they end up? So by reusing, you're really creating a more sustainable option. And that's mm-hmm. that's huge. It's less packaging, and as far as, like, you know, them coming in all boxed up with, you know, styrofoam around them, whatever, it's less garbage, less packaging, and it is such a more sustainable option. So I'd encourage anybody who's doing events, whether you're first starting out or have been doing it for a while, to think about that model of, you know, developing your own in-house supply that you can be
for me, it was
just doing.
It was really all the junk coming in that led to that realization. It was, like you mentioned, the styrofoam. There's so much styrofoam, you know, packing peanuts, plastic, just tons and tons of stuff, lots and lots of cardboard that was just going straight to the recycling bin. Like, not only was it like a pain to unwrap and, you know, get rid of all of that packaging and material and stuff, but it was so disheartening. And I could tell, you know, obviously there's a huge carbon footprint being created with all the shipping of all these heavy vessels every week for all these events all over the country. You know, you think about all that waste, and a lot of them are fragile. So you'd open up all these boxes and get through all the styrofoam and packaging it, and then you have broken vases anyways. Like, what? Oh, it's constantly, you know, making claims about, you know, things that have broken and need to be replaced or refunded. And it's not fun. I'd rather not do that. And then once we get to the events, you know, thinking about small things, you know, for building an arrangement on a arbor or a pergola, how we attach that design to the structure. We can use twine, or we can use these really awesome reusable zip ties now that have kind of like a, I don't know how to explain it, but they just slip on and off, and there's a little bit of a notch and hook system that makes them work, you know, instead of using tons and tons of, you know, it would be hundreds of zip ties for us in a season to build all these wedding arrangements, and then, you know, just to have be cutting them off and throwing away all those little bits of plastic, that didn't feel good. And I know that for people listening, all of these different ideas may seem like a little bit nitpicky. I don't know, but I think when you genuinely care about the environment and you know that, you know, you're dependent upon it for your livelihood, you start to like just think about all these things and notice them, and it affects, you know, maybe the type of delivery van you decide to buy, maybe move to get something that's electric rather than, you know, a big gas guzzler. They're just, there's so many different things to think about. And I think of them as all these different opportunities to be better rather than all these different, you know, rules to live by, I guess.
Exactly. Finding the little ways to, you know, what can you be doing to affect change within your own practice, and if more people are doing it, the impact that can
it's
have
huge. And also, like, I feel like the vast majority of the time these changes are you know, better financially for my business too. They, you know, we're not buying in all this stuff, we're spending less money when we reuse things, and when we're able to buy less fuel and all of that. It's all smart business sense too. Smart in so many ways.
yeah exactly. I mean, everything we've talked about, this, the stamp, it's, you know, more cost effective for us. The reusable zip ties, more cost effective. The reusable vessels, the reusable chicken wire, like all these things are, you know, they're good on more than one level. And like you said, while they may seem nitpicky, it's affecting change in a number of ways within our own businesses, but also within, you know, our impact on the environment. So
it's been fun. Emily, do you have any other thoughts or ideas you want to share?
I think the one thing that we're still trying to figure out is rubber bands, right? Like, I mean, that's an area where both Linda and I are trying to find a solution that's biodegradable, and but also not like, I don't know what the term would be, but I guess over harvesting rubber, you know, that's something that we're still looking into. And when we find a solution,
or if any of our listeners have a solution out there, please let us know too. Yeah.
And I guess if
we know some people, you know, bundle their bouquets and tie them with twine. That's something that neither of us feels is feasible with the quantity of bouquets that we're bunching and making in terms of, you know, moving our things in a timely manner.
If other people have things that they've done, changes they've made within their own growing or floristry, design, you know, whatever business practice that you've maybe noticed, changes that you've made that we didn't touch on, like, please pop onto our Frost on Flowers Instagram and share those there. I mean, I think it's important just to keep the conversation going and to encourage other people to make whatever changes they can to help affect change. That's kind of what we're trying to do here. And like Linda said, we're not the expert on everything, but these are things that we've found are effective and are ways that we can make positive changes. And our hope is that, you know, others will think about them and maybe want to make some changes within their own business and their own practice.
Thanks, Sam. Happy Earth Day, everyone. Yay. All right. Yeah, we'll catch you next time.
Yeah. Happy Earth Day, you guys.
Yeah.
Grow beauty, not garbage.
Thanks again for listening, and be sure to share your questions and ideas for future episodes. You can reach us at frostonflowerspodcast@gmail.com. This podcast is produced and edited by Brad DiArgo. We're so grateful for his help. We'll catch you next time for another cool episode of the Frost on Flowers podcast.